It's Monday morning. Welcome back to Current State. Monday, January 21st, 2013. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're delighted you've joined us for the show here this morning. We are full of good things to talk about here this morning. I think you're going to enjoy today's show. I know I am. Today at 12 o'clock noon in Washington, D.C., Barack Obama is inaugurated for a second term. I read one estimate that 800,000 people are expected to be attending or to be in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. It's America's 57th presidential inauguration ceremony at the Capitol. Our 8th District Congressman Mike Rogers will be in attendance. Congressman Rogers is chair of the House Select Committee on Intelligence and represents Michigan's 8th. Really pleased you made time for us this morning.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before the pomp and circumstance of the inaugural ceremony here, is there anything you can update us on this morning regarding the Algerian tragedy? Where do we stand here first thing Monday morning?
Yeah, we are still going to have to sift through the information we're getting. It was a very remote facility. It was a long way from Algiers, the capital of Algeria, and it was closer to the Libyan border in the middle of no place. So, and the Algerians didn't really want the United States or London or Paris or Tokyo to be at the site while they were conducting their operations. So,
do you respect that decision?
It's not the way we would have done it. Now, but Algeria is in a very different circumstance, and their belief was if they let this thing go on for any length of time, they were putting the price on the head of every Algerian and every foreign worker who works in what is their single largest revenue producer, and that's natural resources, natural gas and oil. And so they believed they had to quickly bring this to an end, and they didn't want to negotiate with all the foreign nation capitals about how they proceed. So they decided they were going to get it done. Now, that means that their tolerance for the survival of the hostages was much less than we would do. And so, you know, it's a decision I think they believe they had to make. It unfortunately was a lethal one for a lot of people, but they believe that it sent a very powerful message to Al-Qaeda and others who are in the business of taking hostages.
In the end, do you wish that Algeria would have taken the United States up on its offer for assistance?
I wish they would have allowed our capabilities to show up and go in. If they were going to make the decision to go in, it would have been great to have some very battle-tested, operation-tested special forces units that are designed for just this kind of an operation. Lots of experience at it. So even though I think the outcome may have been improved just because of the operational quality of the individuals, clearly I wish they had done that. I think we would have had a better outcome for the number of hostages that were killed in the operation.
How good is America's intel regarding North Africa right now?
Well, it's not where it needs to be. We do have lots of threat information and had. Part of the problem was the administration's been a little bit of ignoring of the problem growing in northern Africa. So you have from Mali to southern Algiers, western Libya, Tunisia, now down into Niger in the south, and clearly in Mali. You have Yemen, which is where Al-Qaeda is was holding ground. So it is a growing, dangerous part of the world that we are going to have an overarching policy to handle. You can't do it like a firefighter and say, we'll just deal with Mali. We'll just deal with the hostage situation in Algeria. We'll just deal with Benghazi. It doesn't work that way. It's very fluid. Lots of weapons moving around, lots of bad people moving around. And it's something we're going to have to get a handle on.
Can you comment on the appropriate level of American involvement in that part of the world? Or is that part of the policy statement that you just made a second ago? It just needs to be a part of a policy discussion, comprehensive policy discussion.
Yeah, and it should be. I don't believe we have to have big boots on the ground there at all to accomplish what we need. A great example is the French have asked us for some help. We've given them a little bit. I would give them all of the intelligence capability that we have, and we have a whole list of things that we could provide to them that we haven't quite done. And a French victory against Al-Qaeda in the north of Mali is to the national security interests of the United States. So we don't have to have boots on the ground. We don't have to join them on the ground. But there are a plenty of capabilities that we ought to provide to them, intelligence packages, other types of capabilities that can, I think, quicken their victory over them. And what we don't realize is every victory that they have serves to recruit more people to their cause, and they being Al-Qaeda. And so they're advertising that they're putting the hurt on the French and the Malians. They're advertising that this hostage taking was a victory for them. Even though everyone was killed, it's a victory for them. They had lots of headlines. It was a big splash. It was a politically designed. In other words, before they would ransom for money, this was a change of strategy. They wanted to make a political splash and push back on the French effort against the Malians. So there's a whole host of things we can do short of boots on the ground, and I argue that's what we should be doing.
Is drone technology possibly a weapon there?
Well,
drone technology.
Well, I think airstrikes have been a powerful tool in helping keep Al-Qaeda leadership from having the comfort to design, finance, train, and implement terrorist operations against the United States. So I would use, again, all of the capability that we have in order to bring a quick victory for not only the French and Mali, but to break the back of the groups that think now they can have these big, brazen, emboldened hostage-taking events that I argue are destabilizing to the region and certainly add risk to our national security.
Let's change gears here and talk about the ceremony today in Washington. This is your fourth. How far from the president and from the Chief Justice will you be today?
Oh, probably 15 yards, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really quite an experience. When you look out, there is a sea of people. All the way back to the Washington Monument, and it is really an incredible thing. And I have been to some pretty awful places, you know, the tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen and all of those. And you look at all of those problems they have without transfers of government and tanks in the street, and you look down, and this is the most powerful nation in the world, despite our difficulties, and to see a peaceful transfer of power. When people are still politically divided in this country is an amazing thing, and we
yeah.
should never take it for granted. It is really a powerful thing.
You're in your office right now looking out on the mall. Is that it?
I am in my office. Look, I have a view, kind of a view. If I push my face against the window, I can see the Capitol, but I got to really push hard. And then what we'll do is we'll move over to the House floor here in about a half an hour, and then we'll convene for the House, for the swearing-in, and then we'll move to outside where the actual swearing-in ceremony is, which overlooks the mall.
Very good. Let's get back to issues here. The status quo regarding gun control and regulation is under really intense scrutiny and calls for reform right now. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you enjoy a pretty high rating from the NRA for your defense of gun rights. Are you actively reassessing any past positions on gun control in the aftermath of the Newtown tragedy and the president's proposals last week?
Sure. I was disappointed in the president's proposals. When you look at what happened in Newtown, so you had an individual who had obviously severe mental illness issues steal his weapons from someone else, kill his mother. They were his mother's weapons. Then drive down to the school and kill the children. If you look at all 23 recommendations, not one would have stopped Newtown, not one. And I argue the debate is wrong. Our national debate should be, and if you look at the Gabby Gifford shooting, the Colorado shooting, the Newtown shooting, there is one thing, and by the way, the 23 would have stopped none of those events, not one. What is the one thing, as an old FBI agent, I'm always about trying to get to the bottom of every issue, and it's this mental health. Each one of them either had interaction with police or mental health officials, all of which expressed concern about the behavior and issues that these people had, and we had no mechanism to intervene in their life in any way that would have prevented any of these events. If we are honest about how to solve this problem, that's the debate we should have. And it's a hard one. It's not an easy one. But that's the debate we should have. And all of this other stuff might make us feel good. It will have absolutely no impact on the next mental health issue when somebody gets a hold of somebody else's guns. There are 300 million guns in this country already and does something equally as bad as what happened in Newtown. And so that's been my argument, is how do we change the debate finally to talk about the issue that we know will make an impact for these families, these kids in our country.
We're down to under a minute, Mike. From a strictly legislative point of view, the mental health changes seem to be given the best odds of passage for several reasons. What are the politics of at least moving the mental health piece forward?
Oh, I hope so. And, you know, I can get to background checks. I can do that, no problem. It's this mental health issue that we have to push, and I'm not sure it's strong enough. Hopefully what we'll do is go through what's called regular order to get a mental health package that we all can stand behind. I think we can do it. I believe we can do it, and I believe we should do it.
Interestingly, there's some Senate Democrats that are in from more conservative states that might hang this process up, too, legislatively. We've got to end on that note. I wish we had booked more time with you, but enjoy the day, and we look forward to having you back on Current State real soon.
I look forward to being back. Thanks so much.
It's Current State. Good morning. I'm Mark Bayshore. Brooklyn-based artist Ato Otutigbe's exhibit Loss Prevention opens today here in East Lansing at the Lookout Gallery. And Ato Otutigbe will be in residency at the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities beginning today and through the 26th. That is in Snyder Phillips Hall, the Lookout Gallery, okay? Snyder Phillips Hall here at Michigan State University. The exhibit of Otutigbe's work, which uses multiple media, including sculpture, video, and complex software, runs through February 25th, and we're delighted to have artist Ato Otutigbe in our Current State studios. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning.
Tell us about your, well, I'll tell you what, we spoke briefly with Congressman Mike Rogers just a few minutes ago. You are an American who grew up, as I understand it, in the United States for most of your life.
Yes.
But both of your parents are native Nigerians. Do I have that right?
Yes.
What's your take on all the instability in Africa? I know Nigeria is not exempt from instability these days. We were just talking with Congressman Rogers about it. What's your take on Africa's role in the world right now?
That's a huge question that has a lot of different segments to it.
Sure.
A lot of different issues sort of collide when you talk about conflict in Africa and instability in Africa, past and present. My main concern right now with a lot of the conflicts that are going on in Africa are the human rights issues.
Okay.
The issues that people who are displaced as a result of these conflicts face, whether they're displaced internally or externally.
Okay. Very good. Now let's talk about your exhibit. Describe some of the pieces. It's called Loss Prevention. Tell us about the theme of the exhibit and describe a few pieces for us.
Sure. Loss prevention is a term that you hear sometimes in department stores when you're talking about security or prevention of theft and things of that nature. And I always saw that term growing up, and I thought it could be ascribed to much more noble things when you talk about loss, when you consider loss in our spectrum of human existence. So in loss prevention, I find ways through my practice as an artist to depict loss or to discuss the prevention of loss.
And a lot of this involves tragedies. A lot of this involves some degree of devastation, but you try to find something positive within that.
A lot of the work is related to different personal tragedies that I've experienced throughout my life and using my work to find a way to work through them and to better understand them. So just me as a person can move forward and develop as an artist and a human being, but also I look out into the world and sort of relate some of those issues to my work. I've been sort of in communication with quite a few artists in Egypt, so there's a piece in this show called Outer Sides, where we use the door as a metaphor for communication between America and Egypt.
There's a vote in Egypt this week on that country's constitution, which is going to be a pretty big deal this week. I can't help but flash on that since you mentioned Egypt. But you also talk a lot about rituals in your work. How do you see the various cultural dances that we partake in every day. How does ritual fit in with your work as a pattern?
Yeah, ritual is a form of practice, and it's meant to represent something. It could be religious in nature, it could be spiritual in nature, it could be personal in nature. But that act, or those set of actions that you turn into a ritual, are really important for, sometimes in my work, memorializing things and discussing remembrance.
Okay. You've described race relations in the United States as a dance or a ritual. Tell me more about that. You have this interesting self-portrait in a hoodie that plays off this a bit. It involves the Trayvon Martin controversy.
Yeah, definitely. The name of there's a triptych, so there are three pieces that I call Becoming Visible. And in each of the three pieces, I use a form of carving that creates sort of a holographic effect or a lenticular effect when you walk by them. So if you look at the pieces straight on, you can't make up this image, this self-portrait of me wearing a hoodie. But you have to sort of walk around the image in order for my face to come into focus. So I had the images in another gallery once, and someone mentioned to me, hey, you have to sort of dance around these images in order to understand them. It's sort of how people dance around the conversations about race in this country. A lot of that's because, for Trayvon Martin in particular, I chose to put on the hoodie because it's a form of protest now. A lot of people think the hoodie's like a negative image when you talk about African-American men, but since the Trayvon Martin incident, a lot of different people donned a hoodie as a form of protest to say that, you know, this violence that's happening against black men in this country has to stop.
We're talking with polymedia artist Ato Otutigbe, whose exhibit, Loss Prevention, opens today in East Lansing at the Lookout Gallery. Find that work in Snyder Phillips Hall at Michigan State University. You've said that you're not comfortable using humor in your work, but I have to admit, I got a kick out of the mousetrap piece that I saw a picture of last night. You created a 20 times replica of a Victor pest control mousetrap, and you put yourself in the mousetrap. It seems that people could approach that piece with a certain ironic sense of humor. It could be a lot about oppression. You could read a lot into that piece. But humor is one thing that you could almost see in that piece. Correct?
You're definitely right. I mean, I live in New York, so it's a bit of a play on the rat race in New York and getting trapped in it. But also, it's an entry point into the work, and it's an entry point into lots of more complex conversations that you're alluding to about oppression. And in particular, I have one image of that of the piece that I call Victory, and there's no bait in the rat trap, but I'm still stuck in it. So that alone can lead into many other conversations.
You have a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from MIT. You've got a master's in the field from Stanford, two very strong, rigid institutions. And then you went to what's called a trans art institute, which calls itself an unschool based on learning through life experiences rather than through the institutional educational framework. That sounds like a drastic shift. Has your educational transition redefined for you what education is or can be?
Definitely. As you mentioned, MIT was extremely theoretical in mechanical engineering. Then I went to Stanford, and my focus was more on design, so it became a little more hands-on. Then I went to TransArt, you know, years later, and my course of study was low residency, so part of it was me making work out of my studio and having my advisor come to my studio for critiques. And then the other part involved workshops in Berlin, so I got to spend the summer in Berlin, Germany, which is a booming art capital right now, meeting different artists, making work out there. So I look at education very differently, especially through TransArt, because I used sort of my experience in life and research to develop my art practice. Instead of just responding to things, I developed different ways of understanding how I could process what I was experiencing and what I was reading about in the news and things of that nature, and then turn that into my artwork.
As someone who thinks deeply about cultural hybridity, I guess might be the word. And you yourself have said that being an American raised kid of Nigerian parents and heritage, that there are cultural rituals that compete for influence. What criteria did you use early on to decide which ones make the most sense as you were forming your identity?
Well, definitely. When I was young, my parents, they came to the United States from Nigeria for education. They were students here, and I was actually born in Buffalo, New York, while my mother was in graduate school. So education has always been very important in my family. And I think that formed a lot of my early views. I was always reading a lot as a young child, and I was really into science, science fiction and things of that nature. And I believe those early experiences and just I call it motivation from my parents, because they didn't really force me to do anything. They never really had to tell me to do my homework. I was interested in actually doing it. And that got me interested in science and math. And then I said I want to be an inventor. And then that got me interested in MIT. And then I got more interested in my artwork when I was at MIT. And then that got me interested in more being an artist. So it's sort of been, for me, a natural progression.
We're just about out of time, unfortunately. But what's it like to you knowing your exhibit will be at Snyder Phillips Hall, a residence hall? What's it like for you knowing so many young eyes will be on your work?
I think it's great. While installing the show, I got to learn more about the residence hall and how the dynamics work in there. I make work to dialogue with people, so I think it's great that my work is going to be in a space where people are actually living as well, so they can have more opportunity to interact with it than just in a normal gallery setting.
Our community is really worked up about the opening of the Broad Art Museum. I'm curious if you've already walked through. I hope you plan on going if you haven't walked through.
I definitely plan on going. I have only been here a couple of days installing the show, so I haven't been inside the actual facility yet, but I've driven past it several times, and I'm very much fascinated by the architecture alone.
The building alone. Yeah. I think your eyes are going to be opened by a lot of the pieces in there. It's created a sensation here in Lansing.
I heard there's a great video art show in there right now.
It
that
is.
I want to check out.
Exactly. Ato Ota Tigbe is a polymedia artist, American-raised, but his exhibit, Loss Prevention, opens today in East Lansing at the Lookout Gallery and Snyder Phillips Hall here at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State on WKAR. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Good morning. We do want to pass along our condolences here to the family and friends of Alan Tubbs. Alan, for years, was the planning and development director for the city of Lansing, and I just learned about his death on Saturday in this morning's Lansing State Journal. He was one of the more pleasant interviews that I've had a chance to have over the last couple of years. We talked about the mayoral election of 2008. With Alan outside the Lansing City Market here just over 4 years ago. But we do want to send our condolences out to Alan, his friends, and his family. All this week, Current State includes segments on the North American International Auto Show, and WKAR Scott Pohl was in Detroit a few days ago and visited Cobo Arena, but you were on kind of a dual mission as well. You covered a lot of bases while you were in Detroit, Scott.
Yeah, I did. I went down there on Monday morning, did a few interviews, left and went up to Wayne State University in the middle of the day for the interview we're going to play in a moment. And then later in the day, I went back to the auto show and walked around Cobo Arena some more. But why I'm here today is to talk about the inauguration parade, which is on tap in Washington today. The swearing-in ceremony is at noon. The parade starts at 2:30. I understand C-SPAN will have live coverage that will include the parade. You might find live coverage of the parade elsewhere.
Okay.
But there's a group in Michigan known as the Military Spouses of Michigan, and they'll be marching in the parade. And the president of the group is Jocelyn Benson. She's the dean of the law school at Wayne State.
Sure.
So midday when I was in Detroit, I went up to Wayne State and spent some time with her to talk about how the group serves the loved ones of the men and women who are deployed in the service of their country and how the group got a spot in today's parade.
Our organization started about a year ago when myself and four other military spouses and family members and partners came together and said we really need to do more to build our community here in Michigan. We're scattered throughout the state. Many of us feel isolated and alone. And going through a deployment is a very unique experience. And being able to be around others who are going through a similar experience, sharing the emotions that you're experiencing at that time, is really important to getting through a deployment. And so we organized this group, the Military Spouses of Michigan, to make sure every military spouse in our state knew that they were not alone and that we had their back, and that we were there for them throughout the deployment, the leading up to the deployment, and all of the rest. We've, in the just 1 year, grown to almost 200 members of spouses, family members, partners. Anyone who loves someone in the military is welcome as a member of our organization. We provide social opportunities. We go to Tigers games, and we have monthly brunches. But in addition to that, we provide free legal resources for our family members, as well as job opportunities and information about education and scholarship opportunities.
Tell me about your husband's deployment.
My husband is in Afghanistan right now. He's in the infantry in the Army, and he's been there since June for a number of months. So I've experienced firsthand really how difficult it can be to go through a deployment when you're not located physically on an active duty Army base, which we don't have here in Michigan. And so I don't have access to a family readiness group and all the other resources that spouses usually have access to on a base while they're dealing with a deployment. And that was part of why I wanted to start this group, to basically provide that support for spouses like me. I quickly realized, as my husband actually deployed overseas originally in September of 2011, how lonely and isolating an experience it can be to be a military spouse in our state. And recognizing that, I found that several others were similarly feeling the same way. And we've used this to come together and build a system of support so that we don't have to spend birthdays alone, we don't have to spend holidays alone. And you know, one of the most unique challenges that I found, and that we all found early on to being a spouse while your husband or your spouse is deployed, is that weekend evenings are really difficult, because all of your friends oftentimes are married or off doing date night things, and you don't have anyone to go to the movies with, you don't have anyone to go out to dinner with. And so we provide that support for each other. We have movie nights and we have dinner nights, and it's just a great way to ease some of the stresses of a deployment.
Did you serve in the military yourself?
I did not, no. I do believe that spouses and family members serve as well because of the sacrifice of having our people we love serving overseas, but I've never served in the military.
You mentioned providing legal services,
yes.
And as dean of the Wayne State University Law School, I'm just curious about what you mean by that. If there are specific legal issues that confront spouses of military personnel, if there are other issues that are taken into account for that sort of service?
The cases we've taken on through the Military Spouses of Michigan have been really three types of cases. One are making sure spouses have access to the benefits they're afforded to under the law. There are many federal benefits available to spouses that they don't know about, and so we try to make sure that they have access to the benefits and the protections from being wrongly dismissed from your job and other things. So we've stood up for spouses who've been in those situations. The second area that we focus on are making sure spouses have someone standing with them if they are taken advantage of while their spouse is away. So, for example, one spouse had to deal with her neighbor, an issue with her neighbor who was encroaching on her property, and she needed an attorney to basically write a strongly worded letter to her neighbor not to trespass on the property, and so we were able to do that for her free of charge. And then the third area is representing veterans and other service members who come back and need access to legal services, and we partner with the American Bar Association to provide that service.
Explain the process for being chosen to march in the inaugural parade.
Well, we applied with almost 3,000 other organizations to a search committee back in the fall, and we simply said, you know, we're a group of military spouses and family members in Michigan and would love to play any role that you have for us in the inauguration. And December 19th, we received a call and said, you have 10 days to get us your list of service members and spouses, and we'd love to have you march in the inauguration parade with the president. It has been an incredible thing for our spouses, because so many of our spouses and our members are not politically active. active. They're not, you know, they, but they're incredibly excited about the opportunity to meet, potentially meet the president and have their kids march in this historic occasion. We also have Ford Motor Company, who has donated 11 tickets to the Michigan inaugural ball, and we've given all of those to Michigan spouses and some of the older children who will be coming. And so you hear, we've been having conversations with spouses who are struggling with the deployment, having difficult times financially and making ends meet, and to be able to say, here's a weekend for yourself. Come to Washington, D.C., march in the parade, be honored for the service and the sacrifice that you live every day, and get dressed up, have a good night out at the ball Monday evening. And it's been an incredible thing to be able to offer this to these spouses, and so many of them are so excited. And so I'm very much looking forward to seeing all of them.
How many people are you expecting to take part? Do you have a banner for leading the contingent?
There will be 90 military spouses, service members, and family members marching with the military spouses of Michigan on Monday's parade. We will have a banner with our organization. Everyone will be wearing pins with our logo as well as matching scarves. And then everyone marching will be carrying a flag representing the branch of service that their family member is in. So we have Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marine, Air Force, all the different branches that our service members represent and their spouses will be represented in the parade.
If you had a moment to speak with President Obama, what would you say to him about the needs of military families?
I would say something that I know he's already well aware of, that nearly 25% of military spouses are unemployed and actively seeking employment, and their employment is critical to making sure that our military families are able to fully survive on the pay that they receive as soldiers. And I would remind him that cuts to military spending are important, but we need to be sure those cuts are not borne by the infantry members and the men and women who serve on the front lines. Too oftentimes, that's where the cuts come down and they lose access to important health benefits, retirement benefits, and other things. We need to make sure, we need to recognize that it is our moral obligation to protect and serve those who protect and serve us. And I would hope that he makes that an even higher priority in his second term.
Jocelyn Benson is Dean of the Law School at Wayne State University and President of the Military Spouses of Michigan marching in the inaugural parade. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
State on WKAR. Good morning, I'm Mark Bayshore. You can connect with us via email at currentstate@wkar.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. The Michigan State women's basketball team continued its success at Assembly Hall yesterday, winning its 10th straight game in the building, 56-46 over Indiana. Kiana Johnson posted 15 points, 5 assists, and 4 steals while playing 36 minutes off the bench. MSU improves to 16-2 overall and 4-1 in the Big Ten. The women play Nebraska on Thursday, and the Pistons also were victorious last night over the Celtics, 103-88, now that they're back in this country. So there we go. Pistons and the MSU women both enjoying a victory. It was a pretty exhilarating win for the Michigan State men on Saturday night. Let's go to the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad for his postmortem on that. Good morning, Joe.
Morning, Mark. How are you?
Just fine. Was Saturday night's game a big confidence builder or what?
Well, I think it has to be. It's a significant victory, and you know, it's sort of the same formula Michigan State has been using a lot of games this year, at times against lesser competition. But, you know, Ohio State obviously ranked number 11, a much tougher game, the start of a string of tough games. And the fact that Michigan State was able to, again, kind of hang in, hold a slim lead and finish, I think, you know, Tom Izzo did seem to have more confidence in his team after that, saying, you know, maybe everything they're doing isn't pretty. They're not still operating at full capacity, but they do seem to have that late game toughness. So yeah, I do think they draw some more confidence out of this. And since the Minnesota game to open the Big Ten, they have outperformed their opponents in the last few minutes of games.
Interestingly, I see we're at the very top of the Big Ten this morning. I think we're 5-1, and everybody else, the closest other teams, are 4-1. Do I have that right?
Yeah, alone in first place by a half game because of the extra win, and of course heading to Madison Tuesday, so a win there, and that will continue for a few days. A huge game to me. This game at Wisconsin, if Michigan State can get it, then you can kind of do the math realistically where this team could really contend for the Big Ten. I still think Michigan and Indiana look like the best two teams, but Michigan State is starting to give itself a chance of winning these games it should have won, and then the big one Saturday. So this could get really interesting.
What else in the Big Ten is going on that's grabbed your attention?
Well, like I said, I think that Michigan's win in Minnesota was very impressive. Indiana last night won at Northwestern, but not very impressively. I think Indiana is not playing its best basketball right now. Michigan is. And, sometimes teams play their best basketball in January, and they're not as good in late February, March. And I still think Indiana, when the Hoosiers put everything together, has the best roster in the Big Ten. And, of course, that's the next thing up for Michigan State, Sunday at Indiana. So it's a heck of a week for the Spartans. But, like I said, those two stand out. And, Iowa beating Wisconsin Saturday night after Wisconsin won in Indiana. I think Iowa's a team that really has a chance to make the NCAA tournament this year.
The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad. Thanks, Joe. We'll look for you again on Friday.
Okay, Mark. Thanks a lot.
Have a great week.
We had a lot of very, very good cars. And what we look for is cars that are going to move the needle a little bit in their particular class. So you look at the three finalists. We had the Cadillac ATS, Honda Accord, and the Ford Fusion. I think the Fusion was hurt a little bit by recalls. That didn't make them look very good. And so I think they lost some points there, just judging by what some of my pals have said. The Honda Accord, certainly the best Accord ever made, and that's happened every generation. Does it stand out? They were pretty timid with the styling, I think, or certainly cautious. The rest of the car is very good, but is it ahead of the field, or are they playing catch-up? It's unusual for Honda, but I think they're in the latter category. They're playing catch-up. The ATS is something all new for Cadillac. And anybody that mentions the Cadillac Cimarron now is going to be shot on the spot by somebody from Cadillac marketing. All new car, all new platform, and such excruciating detail in the engineering. Such a lovely car to drive. I think that's why it emerged. And it was it emerged with a very strong percentage of the votes.
The Cadillac Cimarron. I did not expect Tony Swann to go there. That's editor-at-large of Car and Driver magazine. Tony Swann, our Scott Pohl talked with Tony at the North American International Auto Show, and Tony was on the jury that chose the Cadillac ATS as the North American International Auto Show Car of the Year, the Lansing-made Cadillac ATS. And at the auto show, he said that in his 20 years on the jury, this was the best field of cars he has ever seen. So that's quite an endorsement for the current crop of cars. MLive's Angela Whitrock stands by to talk a little bit more about that, about GM and other business and economic news. How are you this morning?
Fabulous and cold. How are you, Mark?
Fabulous and cold and snowy.
Very snowy.
That's right. We've got General Motors was in the news as well just a couple of days ago, and you've been following this. Is Government Motors about to become history?
It is, yes. The federal government is preparing to sell off the rest of its shares, about 300 million shares of GM that remain. This is huge, actually. General Motors bought back about 200 shares in December. 200 million shares in December. So these remaining 300 million shares will go on the market, and hopefully for more than what the last round of sales went for.
The prices are a little bit higher than just a month ago, right?
And like you mentioned, you know, this strong crop of cars that are being fielded, it's like the barometer has moved higher for the entire class of cars worldwide. GM is still floating near the top, and that's helping their stock prices. So that will be a better deal for taxpayers ultimately, because a lot of these shares will go for higher than the last round did.
You can only imagine how annoying the whole Government Motors moniker became for Dan Akerson, the guy who wants to turn this company around. It's so many other people at the top of GM.
Right, and you know, to be fair, a lot of auto companies over the years have taken advantage of various federal tax incentives, federal loans, low-interest loan guarantees. I mean, there's never been a time in American history, really, where the government hasn't been part of the auto industry.
Well,
that
Chrysler,
speaks to
Chrysler bailout.
That speaks to how important the auto industry is to the states and states like Michigan.
Lindsay Van Hulley's piece, this is the second week in a row we've invoked Lindsay's work in the Lansing State Journal, but her piece yesterday on the luxury rental market in Lansing was very interesting. Apparently, the demand for higher-end rental units in Lansing is going up, at least to listen to developers like Pat Gillespie and others.
Right, yeah, and that's something that I think is surprising a lot of people. If you follow a lot of development news, maybe it's not so shocking, but you know, there are folks who don't want to buy a home, who don't want to be tied down, as Lindsay mentioned in her story, who want to have the flexibility to move in somewhere and not have to maintain a home, not have to mow a lawn, not have to shovel a sidewalk, and still have all the amenities you would have if you perhaps bought a home in White Hills, but without, you know, cleaning out the gutters yourself. And I think what that does is that attracts the same sort of folks to the city that the city realizes has historically been important to upping the average income and spending more money locally. What we used to call the creative class, but what we now think of more as young urban professionals who have good paying jobs and want to stay close to downtown.
I noticed the threshold, they peg the threshold for what the luxury market starts at $900, but the average rental prices in Lansing are significantly less than that. It triggered the inevitable question over whether or not some number of people are going to end up being priced out of downtown Lansing apartments.
I think that's always it's a delicate balance. It's cynically what we would call gentrification.
Sure.
You know, folks move into a cool, hip area and push out the lower income residents. I think, you know, there has to be a concerted effort to make sure that the city is accessible to everyone who wants to live there. And I'm sure that this is something that, you know, the brilliant minds of the city like Joan Jackson Johnson and Bob Johnson will be looking at to make sure it happens.
And local governments love the revenue, as Lindsay pointed out in her piece. I mean, it is. I found it surprisingly encouraging news about the city of Lansing. But at the same time, there is this piece about some people being priced out. But the local governments love the revenue that goes with it, too.
Right. And, you know, the great thing about a city like Lansing is that it is so large, it can absorb a tremendous amount of folks. There is a huge stock of housing still ready. You know, I don't think there's any immediate danger in someone not being able to find affordable housing. Maybe 10 years down the road, it'll be something more pressing. And, you know, you would hope that city officials would start looking at the mechanics to make sure that doesn't happen.
What's the status? You did some reporting here late last week on the status of the Lansing Brewing Company moving into the Stadium District. It still looks like a go, but it's taking a little longer to unfold.
Right. Well, Pat Gillespie, who you mentioned earlier, he runs the Stadium District. That's his development. He and the owner of the Lansing Brewing Company, Mark Sellers, have yet to reach an agreement on a lease. Now, the space they're looking at is this northwest corner, which has yet to be occupied since the inception of the Stadium District. It would be, you know, really quite a fabulous location if we could have a brew pub across the street from, you know, the actual stadium. But right now it's looking a little iffy, but both sides are pretty hopeful that they can get a deal done in time to make sure everything happens on schedule.
This is over 6,000 square feet.
Correct,
I understand. Okay. And this guy is also, you mentioned this last week, the Hop Cat.
Right.
And you referred to this in your MLive story as the Hop Cat concept,
right,
in a way. What did that mean?
Well, this is why folks are so excited about the Lansing Brewing Company and the Hop Cat East Lansing coming. Mark Sellers has a tremendous reputation, and what he did with the Hop Cat concept is offer craft beers on tap. What we would have in East Lansing, and that's a go, is about 100 craft beers on tap at the corner of Grove and Albert, I believe.
The Residences.
The Residences, yep. And, you know, again, this would be really something that appeals to the same market of folks who are looking at these luxury apartments, craft beers, and, you know, spending more money downtown.
What stories are you covering here the rest of the week, today and the rest of the week?
I'm looking again at gas prices. I'm looking at what we're going to see in the State of the City address from Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero, and trying to follow along these wonderful car news we're hearing about.
Have you given any more thought to going to the car show?
I have, because I really want to see the Viper and the new Corvette.
That was the other big story in the Free Press yesterday. They did pages on the new Viper from Chrysler.
Yeah, it looks amazing and, as you know, fast.
I love going to the car show, but I prefer to go Sunday as opposed to Saturday. Saturday, it can be a madhouse, but that's success for you. MLive's Angela Whitrock, many thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, it's Current State here on WKAR. Good morning. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Also find us on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at KAR. Current State. Coming up tomorrow, we've got the Michigan Department of Natural Resources Chief, along with Kirk Heinze, that's Keith Cray of the DNR, joins us tomorrow, along with Kirk Heinze of the Greening of Michigan program, and we look forward to that exchange. Again, we're always eager in your eager to hear your feedback and your ideas for story segments. Current State at wkar.org. We hope you have a great day.